The Virginia Voice presents What's Your Story? Our program is based on the idea that everybody has a story to tell. All you have to do is ask. Now, here's the host of What's Your Story, Don Dale.
Hello, and welcome once again to What's Your Story? My guest this time is Maurice Duke, who is a retired professor of English literature at VCU. In part one of our interview, Maurice Duke talked about his childhood in Powhatan and Richmond, about joining the Navy, learning to appreciate literature as he served as a sailor, and his 33-year career as a professor of English literature at Virginia Commonwealth University. Today we're going to talk about two aspects of Maurice's amazing experiences that we didn't get to touch on last time, and both of them will be immediately familiar to people who have read recent history or even lived through it. But let's talk about Hiroshima.
Okay.
You were there shortly after the bomb was dropped.
Ten years after.
Mm-hmm. So there was some time to recover.
Oh, yes, yes. The city had recovered substantially when I was there. But there was still a good deal of indication of what had happened and of the bomb.
Mm-hmm. Little Boy was
yes.
the name of that atomic bomb that was dropped on the Japanese city of Hiroshima on August 6, 1945.
Right.
By the Boeing B-29 Superfortress named Enola Gay, piloted by Colonel Paul W. Tibbets, Jr., who was commander of the 509th Composite Group of the U.S. Army Air Forces. That was the first atomic bomb to be used in warfare, and the Hiroshima bombing was the second artificial nuclear explosion in history after the Trinity test, and the first uranium-based detonation.
Yes.
What evidence did you see when you were there 10 years later?
It was frightening. Even though it was 10 years later, a good bit of the city had been rebuilt. But there was still evidence of the blast. I think the worst thing was seeing the bomb was, it was an air blast, you know, above the ground, several hundred feet up. And it formed sort of an umbrella as the blast covered the city. It was detonated right over top of a church. And strangely enough, the church, or at least the sort of a skeleton of the church, was left standing. I remember standing not too far from that skeleton of the church. And then on the sidewalk in front of me were people who had witnessed the blast, or had undergone the blast, well, suffered the blast. You'd look at them straight on, they looked perfectly normal. And you look at the other side of them, and the skin looked like it was melted on them, where they had been burned. It was ghastly, that's a term that I would use. I felt rather strange standing there in a U.S. Navy uniform seeing these people.
Is that why you were there? You were in the Navy?
I was in the Navy. I was there taking pictures. And I was there. There's a peace garden or something like that. There's a wall there about, 8 feet tall or so. And I guess 12, 15, 18 yards long. On the wall itself, there are a number of silhouettes of people, almost like a piece of modern artwork. And you don't pay attention to it until you realize that this was the shadows or the silhouettes made by the blast when the people walked by. And it etched the image around them into the wall. It was very frightening.
That was one of the things I wanted to ask you about.
Yes.
When I was younger, I remember seeing images of shadows on a sidewalk that had been etched in
yes.
by the terrible power, fury
yes.
of the atomic blast.
Yes.
I can't even imagine that.
It's hard to imagine. Well, I couldn't imagine it either until I had the opportunity to work on this photo assignment at Yucca Flats, American Desert in California, Nevada, I'm sorry. And I saw three of those atomic bombs set off about 4 o'clock in the morning, And you can see, if you've been there and also been to Hiroshima, you can see the damage that they can do. These blasts would go off in total darkness. We were there with cameras running and stills and movies too. And the whole world, literally, well, everything that you could see was lighted up just as if it were the middle of the day in the summertime, even though it was dark. And it's bang, all at once, everything you can see, horizon to horizon, is light. And then the blast will start to wane and come back in to the point of the actual point of the blast where the bombs were set off, and you're back in total darkness again. And you realize the enormous power that it had. We had several people who were knocked off the top of a bus taking pictures there that morning.
And this is miles away from the Texas.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we were way up on the rim of the canyon, and the blast was way down in the valley, a long ways away from us. They were set to blast off, and it was so long ago, I don't remember for certain, but about 10 seconds or so that the shock wave would hit us. Mm-hmm. And it was, some of the people knocked down, who knocked off a bus up there with one of the blasts, and I was not hurt in any way, but it rippled your clothes just as if you sort of, for a second, you're in about a 60-mile-an-hour wind, and then it's gone.
So you got to see the tests.
Yes.
Yucca Flats in Nevada.
Yes.
And then you saw Hiroshima 10 years later.
Well, actually, it was the other way around. I saw the blast after Hiroshima. But I could put the two together, obviously. I saw the blast in about 55 or something like that, roughly. Mm-hmm. 57. 1957, I saw the blast, and I had been to Hiroshima in 1955.
When you went to Hiroshima, you were taking pictures, but what was your assignment? Who were you taking pictures for?
We had the big ships, like the ship that I was on at that time, an aircraft carrier. They do what's called a cruise book, and it's kind of like a college book, you know, that when you're senior, you get the book and so forth. Mm-hmm. Well, they do the same thing, and they call them a cruise book. And I was shooting for the cruise book.
Something like a yearbook.
Exactly, like a yearbook, that's right. And so that's what I was shooting for.
And the pictures, do you still have them?
I don't have any of the pictures. Well, I have some of the pictures I shot in the Navy, but most of my stuff was published in book form or newspapers or Associated Press would pick it up or something such as that.
I'm not sure how to frame this question.
Yeah.
It must have had an overpowering emotional impact on you to see what destruction had been wrought.
Well, that happened. I was there in 1955. It is now 2014, and I still recall it vividly. And I know the power of those blasts and what they can do. It made a life impression on me.
Did you get any inkling or any indication of the feeling 10 years later of the Japanese people?
Yeah, I did, especially because I spent several years in Japan as a photographer. And yes, I did have the feeling, and I had Japanese friends that I would talk with, and I know about the invasion of Japan in 1945, and I had a friend who fought at Iwo Jima, and I had several friends who had come into Japan in the summer of 45 when we came in as an occupying force.
Right. Mm-hmm. Was there a prevailing anti-Americans?
No, there was not. The Japanese people that I knew and saw everywhere out in the streets and talked with in shops for the several years that I was there were very friendly people, and I have a tremendous respect for Japanese culture to this day. I got interested in Japanese literature, read a good bit of that. I went to the Kabuki Theater, I went to see the No Drama, and I went on another different assignment down in Kyoto, which was an ancient capital of Japan, had the opportunity to go in one of the major temples there, meditated in the garden and such things as that, and was very well received by everyone. I never met in Japan, in the years that I was there, a person who was hostile to what we had done at the end of the war.
How can that be?
I don't know. I wish I could tell you, but that's the case. I spent off and on about 3 years working on a shore base about 20 or 30 miles south of Tokyo. Worked with Japanese people, very good to work with. When I went down to Kyoto, I went as a cinematographer, to help them photograph the NOAH drama, that's pronounced NOAH, and they were very receptive of me as a photographer, and we worked together very well. But no, I never encountered the animosity that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. The only place I ever saw it was in the bad movies of the 1950s and 60s.
It must have made a heck of an impression.
It did. It still does. It still does.
And there's one more thing that we didn't get to talk about last time that I find fascinating, especially since you've shared the video record of the voyage, and the voyage of Godspeed.
Oh, yeah.
The replica. Godspeed, as most Virginians know, was one of the three ships, along with the Susan Constant and the Discovery, which sailed from England to Jamestown, 1607, and established the first permanent English settlement in the New World.
Correct.
Jamestown,
that's
just
right
down the road,
yeah,
from us. And in 1985, there was a replica of the Godspeed, which sailed from London to Virginia, and you were on that voyage. How did you get to be on that voyage?
Well, it was one of those things. They were looking for somebody who had sailing experience, extensive sailing experience, and they were looking for a still photographer, a cinematographer, and a journalist. And as it happened, I fit all the categories. Mm-hmm. At the time, I had a captain's license for sailboats, auxiliary sailboats. And I did charter work here on Chesapeake Bay in a variety of vessels. I, of course, had worked for the newspaper and, of course, a number of years as a photographer, and in the Navy as also as a cinematographer.
So, the newspaper being the Times Dispatch.
Right, yes, that's right.
And the News Leader in those days.
In those days, both papers, yeah.
When you first saw the Godspeed, it's tiny.
It's small.
Could you imagine crossing the Atlantic in that, sailing, what that ship did?
Well, I had, a couple of things. One is, I feel comfortable in the oceans. I'm not afraid of the ocean. I have tremendous respect for it, unbelievable respect for it, but I'm not afraid. We had people on the Godspeed, on the replica voyage, who were pretty well seasoned as sailors, and I felt like we were safe and comfortable. I'm not sure we were, but I felt that way.
Describe the ship for me. What was it like? What did it look like?
Well, you take a watermelon, cut it in half, and go to sea in half of it. That's about it. It was a terribly rough riding vessel. It had a round bottom on it, which meant that it would roll very easily. And we would, on occasion, when we were out in the Atlantic, we would be sailing with the lee rail, and that was one of the sides of the ship, almost touching the water, come about on the tack and head in a different direction. The ship would flip like it was going to turn over and put the other lee rail down on either the port or starboard side. Well, we were concerned enough that we had a jack line, as they called them, running down the center of the ship that we could hold on to. And we would, at nighttime, when we were relieving each other on the watch, one guy would get on one end of the jack line and the next guy on the other end. You'd work toward each other, hold each other like a couple of teenage lovers, and work around each other, pick up the other side of the line and go forward or aft, whichever way, because we were concerned about the possibility of being thrown over the side. If it had happened, if one of us had gone over the side, we would have been lost. There was no way to a ship of that kind to be able to get the ship around, sail back and pick up that person. And so we knew that, and we were very careful. And we also trailed a long line off the stern, so in case you did go over, that you could swim to that line, pick it up, and work your way back to the ship.
How many people?
13.
It just seems incredible to me. I mean, why did these 13 people decide they were going to sail across the Atlantic in half a watermelon?
It was fun.
Some might say so.
I've always been sort of an adventuresome person, and the idea of sailing on a 17th century ship, since I taught English literature and I taught Shakespeare and things like that. And it was interesting to me to find out the kinds of vessels that those original people came across in. And that was the reason. I just wanted to do it just for the excitement of it.
What brought about the building of the reproduction and the voyage itself? Was there some occasion that was being marked?
Well, it really wasn't. They were building the first replica ship was in bad condition in 1985. And they knew they had to replace it. And the people at Jamestown talked about the possibility of making a new ship. And then somebody said, well, why don't we make a new ship and sail it across like they did in 1607? And the idea caught on, and we did it. That was it.
So there were replica ships already at Jamestown?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was not seaworthy, but yeah, they were there. Uh-huh.
And so this was an adventure.
It was. It was.
And one heck of an adventure.
And it also, you know, there's always been some quarrel between Virginia and Massachusetts about the first English settlers. Actually, the first English settlers in this country came to Jamestown. People think they came to Massachusetts in 1620, but that's not the case. The Jamestown colony was the first one. We always emphasize, and still do, that it was the first permanent English settlement in North America.
So we're getting close to the voyage now, in 1985, and you board in, not London, because, or did you?
No, we up in Ipswich. We went aboard in Ipswich, brought the ship down to London, put it on display at St. Catherine's Dock, right at the Tower Bridge, for a couple of weeks before we made the actual voyage.
And this was all done under sail. There was no auxiliary engine.
No, we had no auxiliary engine.
You had radios?
No, yeah, oh, yes, we had radios. We had no engine, but we didn't sail it down from Ipswich to London. We were towed down there. And when we left London and went down the Thames to go into the ocean, we were sent off by, I don't know what the cadets were, they were Royal Navy cadets or whatever. Anyway, they rowed us out, pulled us out with rowboats just like it would have in 1607. And then they cast us off, and we had a heck of a time getting out of the English Channel and into the ocean, because with a ship of that era, it won't sail toward the wind. Modern vessels will, not directly into the wind, but pretty close. But the 17th century ships would sail only parallel to the wind. So we had a hard time getting out of the channel. And when we finally got out, we were okay then.
That was. Did you have doubts about being able to get out, or was it a bad time of year?
We were late. Later than we should have been. We were waiting for members of the royal family to come aboard and inspect the ship. Prince Philip, for example, came aboard, and his schedule was such that we had put off leaving for, I don't know how long it was, 3 or 4 weeks, something such as that. And then we got out, we picked up the Portuguese trade winds, Portuguese trades, sailed down to whatever the latitude was, 30 degrees, and then came across. Back in the days, this was in the era before they had any way of determining north and south. They could determine east and west, but not north and south. So the saying used to be that you would leave England, sail south until the butter melted, turn left and go to the continent. And that's what we did.
And the reality of all that is that you sailed down to Tenerife?
We sailed to Tenerife, and that's where the original voyage I sailed, it was to Tenerife.
And then the ship went across the Atlantic.
That's right.
But towards South America, right? I mean, if it had gone straight, it would have hit South America?
Well, we went, no, they went into the islands, into the, well, Leeward or Leeward as it's really pronounced, into the Leeward Islands and St. Martin's and St. Kitts and places such as that.
In the Caribbean.
That's right, in the Caribbean.
And then up to...
And then up, that's right.
And that's the way they did it in 1606, that's 1607.
That's right. There was an interesting thing with those original voyages. They would sail north after they left the Caribbean. Sail north, take soundings. That means, you know, check, see how deep the water is and see the condition of the bottom of the ocean at that point. When you got to the point that you were picking up shells in the soundings, you knew that you were off the Chesapeake Bay, because the shells had washed over centuries and centuries out into the ocean, and then you would turn to port and you come on into the mouth of the Chesapeake.
Did you have any trepidations about the danger involved in doing this before you started?
Well, I'd say we all thought it was a risk, but an acceptable risk. That's the way we saw it. Nobody had any trepidation about it once we got underway, I think.
When did you eat?
We had a cook aboard who had a retired Navy cook who had roughly 25 years in the Navy, and he was excellent. And he did all the shopping, and we had good food all the way.
But he had to cook on a boat that was rocking, what, 20 degrees in the weather?
Oh, yeah, that's right, he did. And we had a cookhouse, I guess you could call it, forward in the ship, and a stove in that. And he would cook, you know, on that stove and pass the trays up. And we had no table to sit at, so we just held the trays in our lap and ate as we were underway. Of course, if the weather was really up and rough, he couldn't cook. But that's just the way it is today. When I was on destroyers in the Navy, U.S. Navy, we would hit periods that you couldn't eat, couldn't get cooking done. Coffee made, such things as that. In some cases, even to the present day, on the smaller ships, and I was on some of those too, you get on your knees and crawl from the passageways from area to area. So you get tossed around on those small vessels.
You had the advantage of knowing where you were going.
That's true. That was a big thing, a really big thing.
And in 1607...
They didn't even know where they were going to sleep when they got here. And we were tired and pretty well beat when we got ashore here in Virginia. And I thought often of those guys who sailed to the end of the earth from their point of view.
Right.
And then I had to eke a living out of the wilderness, build houses and... a number of them did starve to death on the first winter, I hear.
You stopped at a number of places.
I left the ship at Tenerife.
Tenerife is where exactly?
In the Canaries, off the coast of Africa. And I left the ship at Tenerife because I've always had a tendency to motion sickness. And I had the worst motion sickness that I've ever had. On the Godspeed. I lost 30 pounds between London and Tenerife.
Over what period of time?
Roughly a month.
30 pounds
yes.
a month.
Yeah. And I was pretty well exhausted, and the ship's doctor, I wanted to go on, and I wanted to make that whole voyage. The ship's doctor told me he wouldn't recommend it, that I ought to leave, because if something were to happen, that they had to airlift me, we would be out of the regular trade routes by then, and it would be hard to get a vessel in there to get me off. And so I left at Tenerife. My replacement came aboard, And so that's where my section of the voyage ended.
But the voyage continued across. Did you catch up with them or see them at any point?
No, I followed carefully with them. Our people here in Virginia had radio contact on a regular basis, so I knew what was going on. They had no problems until they got off the coast of North Carolina and ran into the first nor'easter of the year. And as you know, here in Virginia, a nor'easter means that the bad weather's coming from the northeast and it's blowing you right ashore. And on what is called the graveyard of the Atlantic, and it is, there are hundreds of ships on the bottom of the ocean.
This is off of Hatteras.
Off of Hatteras. Right. The old sailors used to have a saying, if Virginia lets you pass, then you must get by Hatteras. and that's dangerous, you know, going around there. Yeah. I sailed it before, sailed to Bermuda in a modern sloop, and it's a tricky coast to navigate.
What did you learn on the voyage? What do you think you took away from it?
The most important thing, I guess, was learn. I was still teaching at the time at the university, and I knew what it was like to sail a 17th century ship. I knew what the settlers went through in coming here, and that was the most important thing, I believe.
Do you think that they were especially talking about 1607, 1606, 1607,
yeah,
that voyage? Do you think that they were extremely brave people, or what motivated them to come to America?
Probably money more than anything else.
Mm. There was the Virginia colony was founded as a commercial enterprise.
That's right, it was. And it was all sorts of erroneous information about what they would find when they got to Virginia. Some even thought they would find gold on the, they could pick it up out of the forest, you know. And that, of course, was not the case. They needed to find, and that was one thing, is for money. And another, and this was a order from the crown, from the king, was to find a passage to the Pacific, because they thought, and logically so, they thought that Virginia was just like a long peninsula, and that they could sail right through there and be a passage through there, maybe a couple of hundred miles or so. They thought that because the earlier voyages had come to the Panama, and you can walk the Panama, well, it, I don't know what it would take, a few days from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and they thought they were going to find the same thing up here. Of course, they were thwarted in that quest, because there's no way they could get through there. So they tried a glass making venture at Jamestown, that was one of the main things. And the colony was just about ready to fail when supplies came from England to resupply them, and they barely hung on. And then the most important thing of all was that John Rolfe, who later married Pocahontas, John Rolfe smuggled some tobacco seed from Caracas to Virginia, planted it, and it took off like wildfire across the whole world. The Virginia tobacco was excellent tobacco, and would be, I guess the equivalent today would be having a federal license to grow and sell all the marijuana that you want to see. And smoking became so popular in England that school kids were instructed or required to bring their pipes, smoking pipes, to school so the teacher could teach them how to smoke properly. It was slavery and tobacco that that saved this colony.
And it's absolutely unimaginable that they, in a small ship with a dozen or so people,
yeah,
on each ship, would just sail off into the unknown, looking for the passage to Asia.
Yeah.
And make that voyage.
They didn't live long. They knew they were not going to live long. And they were brave. They were brave people. Maybe in some ways, perhaps even foolhardy. It was quite usual to find sailors who were missing toes because they were frozen off and from frostbite. And these guys had climbed the rigging, of course we had climbed the rigging too, And they just have a very, very, very hard time of it.
But it's been a full life.
Well, yes, I've been very fortunate, extremely so.
Is it just a case of grabbing the adventure when you can?
That's what I did, and still did. I still do, up until quite recently when I began to have health problems, which you expect at age 80. Mm-hmm. I would go again in a minute if I were physically able.
Well, you walked in here on your own 2 feet. You get credit for that.
Well, that's one accomplishment of old age. I made it down the hall.
My guest this time on What's Your Story has been Maurice Duke, a retired professor of English literature at VCU, who's been telling us about one of the more interesting lives that I've heard about in recent years. Thank you for being our guest.
Happy to be here. Enjoyed it.
I'm Don Dale, and I hope you'll join us next time on the Virginia Voice for What's Your Story?
You've been listening to What's Your Story with Don Dale. If you know somebody with a story to tell, or if you'd like to tell your own story, telephone the Virginia Voice, 804-266-2477. And be sure to join us next time for What's Your Story? This is Charles Mink speaking, and this is the Virginia Voice.